Welcome. It's nice to have you here.
I'm so glad you could come. This is going to be such an exciting day. I hope you enjoy it. I think you will.
Open your mind real wide now.
I'm freaking out, man.
You are freaking out, man.
Welcome aboard the Mothership Radio Show. I'm Kevin Gassman. Tonight we're talking prog rock with the multi-talented producer, songwriter, vocalist, instrumentalist, Robert Berry, who is also the third member of the band Three, and that was with Carl Palmer and Keith Emerson of Emerson, Lake & Palmer fame. Robert was on a couple years ago when he dropped his album The Rules Have Changed. That album included a lot of music that was collaborated with Keith Emerson under the band 3.2. Now, one song didn't make it to that album, but did make it to Robert's latest album called Third Impression, which is out now. That song is called Never, and we're going to get into a conversation about that song on the album and how the album was put together, because prog rock has a lot of long songs, and I love long songs, so I had to ask him about that. So we get into that conversation a little bit later on, but first, we will talk about one specific song and video that goes along with it called A Fond Farewell. So that will start our conversation off with Robert Berry, as we get strange and unusual with him, right here on the Mothership Radio Show.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
What if I told you I'd take you to a place you'd never been and do something to you that's never been done?
You're a sci-fi guy too, right? Which prog rock and sci-fi go hand in hand, so...
I was going to say, you know, your video, A Fond Farewell. let me read the intro here. The year is 2141. After the Great Meltdown, what remained of humanity migrated to the International Space Station. All communication with Earth ceased as no survivors were left behind, or so they thought.
Yeah.
And that's your... that's.
And there's this one guy, that was all done in Italy. This one guy, they sent me the first cut of it. And, you know, he's kind of happy-go-lucky. He's skipping around. He's, you know, I don't know where the big round NASA building in Italy.
I was going to ask you, yeah.
and I got it. And I said, it came together really good. But this guy cannot be happy the whole time. Come on, we got to do something where he's despondent. And finally, when the space station explodes, they did something else too. But they added one thing. He turns the oscilloscope. They're using the monitor. He turns it off. All hope is gone, right? I said, that's it. That's all it took. I feel better about it now. So I can't have the guys skipping around.
I liked it because it seemed like, you know, he understood he was the only guy on Earth. And kind of like that feeling of, like, I might as well enjoy my time while I'm here. I mean, because there's nobody watching me anymore, and I just can be myself. And then the reality of, wait a minute, I really am the only guy here. Can I reach out to anybody? And then all of a sudden I won't ruin the video, but you know, things change. And now you realize you really are alone until the very end of the video. But you know, what was that like writing the song, A Fond Farewell? Did you have that in mind as far as the last of humanity? Is that, you know, that the song is really?
No, I didn't. It's, you know, every song or every album is a time stamp of the time that you do it in, kind of, you know, and you're affected by your surroundings. I am really sick and tired of people that hide behind Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and all that, think they can say whatever they want. Friends of mine. And that I don't care if their beliefs are different or not. I just don't want to hear F this. There's a bunch of idiots. You know, everything's mean. So I put it this way. When I was young, I wouldn't say like the word shit in front of my parents. No way. Even damn or hell, right? My son uses the F word like it's staying kind of a candy, you know? And I'm okay with it. It's not that big a deal. And when I was with Sammy Hager, I mean, Sammy, that's all he said. F, you know, right? And I'm always saying F because I don't know what your show allows. So
you're okay. I mean, I can edit out.
Well, you find that as time goes along in society, things that are let to happen, let's say, like saying F all the time, it gets disarmed. Like seeing a school shooting on a Friday night in the news, and by Monday we're off doing something else, not even thinking about it. But we're saying goodbye to kindness, kind of, and we're saying a fond farewell without really thinking about it. I'm not sure that a certain age group realizes that schoolyard, hey, buddy, yeah, I know you are, but what am I, that is going on social media is growing and getting worse all the time. And we're just not going to be able to pull back to being decent people if it gets to be like the F word is now. Does that make sense?
Because you're not seeing their face, they have an avatar as their photo, and, you know, it kind of gives them maybe more confidence to, you know, I don't know, be rude, maybe be rude on purpose just to rile people up, or to maybe really, because, you know, I mean, I've talked about this before, is, you know, the majority of people on this planet really do operate at a pretty young mentality.
Yeah.
I mean, I worked in news, and when I was going through college and learning about writing for news, one of the things that stuck out to me was that when you write for the news, and I'm talking about the 11 o'clock news on your local TV, or 10 o'clock if you're in the Midwest, that you write for the mind of a 12-year-old. You write for the mind of someone in eighth grade, seventh grade, whatever it is, so that you can comprehend it. If you listen to the news, you'll understand, you'll hear it. You'll hear how simple their explanation is and how simple they tell the story, because it needs to be simply received. So I think when you take that in consideration and you look online and you got, you know, 100 million people on Facebook, the percentages of people who are, you know, only at that level to a certain degree haven't really developed any kind of skills. They don't understand of, you know, what humanity is or empathy is or sympathy. And that's what I kind of feel. I feel like they still need to learn that their words mean something. They need to learn. I mean, we all learn this as a kid, but you don't really take it in until you know, maybe get older and have like a real life lesson about it.
Well, we learn by example though, right? I mean, when we're kids, if you get in a fight or something, you learn that maybe that's not the best thing, especially if you lose, right. You know? And if the teacher's mad at you, it's face to face. I mean, whatever. All these little battles teach you how to get along in society. You don't have a battle when you're online spewing out a bunch of crap that, and you can believe it, everyone. It's not that. I'm not criticizing that at all. It's just the song was about saying goodbye to kindness.
That kind of thing.
And that the social getting along kind of. What was funny, you asked me at the video, I had an idea. And the studio is pretty big here. So I was going to have some very big 3 or 4 video screens behind me. And I had all these cards made up, gambling cards. And you know, there'd be like a Hitler, a Stalin, and a Mother Teresa. And, you know, and during the song, at certain points when I was singing, you know, someone would pull a handle and it would flip around. If it was a bad thing, my idea was to, you know, oh my God, you know. And it's a good thing. It's, you know, it's a big smile. I mean, that was the basis of it. It was a lot deeper than that. I sent it to a record company in Italy. They said, we really hate that idea. So I said, okay. I said, you have an idea? Yes, we do. I said, okay, well, let's see what you do. I didn't even know the premise of it until I got the first cut of the video. And I was blown away. I said, wow, you guys really care about this album, this song, because I haven't seen a video for any band like that for quite a while, you know, that, my God, location, the subway that was all burned out or whatever, yeah. Trapped. Man, come on.
Right.
And this, the guy, the actor in Italy is going through these places. So it's not stock footage. They actually did this.
I was going to say, I wanted to ask you where they filmed it. And then also, like, was that a stage set up or is that like a real place that they just decided to film? It seems like a real place It is
all real places except for the NASA building. They don't have one of those in Italy, I don't think.
Not yet, right?
No, not yet.
No, but I like that message though, because, you know, when you talk about, you know, saying goodbye to certain things that humanity is, you know, not practicing anymore in a sense. I mean, look, I live in a quiet neighborhood in the suburbs of LA, and I don't see kids playing in the streets. You know, I don't, everything has been so, like, the internet's a great thing, but it's also, you know, it's removed us from human contact. So when you don't have that, I guess it feels free to be as nasty as you want and not care about anyone or not care about what you're saying just because, you know, you think that way. You want to, you know, brag, you want to pound your chest a little bit, and maybe it makes it feel better, but it's, in a sense, it just, it continues on the whole, decline that you're talking about. It really does.
I'm worried about. Yeah, I'm really worried about that. If it's not, you're not just discussing it, but you know, it needs to be taught in school, kind of. You know, it needs to be like, hey, you know, look at what social media does. We don't want to be like that, do we, class? We have friends. We like hanging out. Do you like? If you don't like hanging out, okay. You know, like something to make them realize. Well, for me, here's some things that are lost. You know, holding a newspaper that you get every morning and you look forward to it like you do a cup of coffee, or an album cover. You know, this is the new album. I only have a CD. I'm pressing an album now, but I had to do. Here's the first one, 1988. I had to do a vinyl because the music's so important to me. And I wanted this big layout for the people that like it, because there's an emotional connection with the physical product. And when you can read it, and then it's a piece of art. Now, the kids have already lost that. That, you know, anybody below maybe 30, that's not important to them. Maybe below 35, 40, I don't know. But it's just not important because they didn't experience it. If they experienced it, they would get that emotional connection to the art itself. Hey, here's something that scared me. Just yesterday I was reading, because I have an X Tesla, my wife has an X, and I have a Roadster, the proof of concept, the first year they made them. It's so fast. So I'm looking at the new Teslas. They've upped the S model a little bit. And I don't know if you're a gamer, you play, you know, online games. I don't, because I'm so busy at the studio. So you're not that big.
Old school arcade.
Well, okay. The new Tesla S has some kind of screen that is best for gaming. That's part of a car now?
Yeah.
What? It's a high, you know, I don't know if it's a 4K screen and it has this kind of density and this and that for gamers. I'm in your car. Of course, they're into the self-driving thing. So they're thinking on long trips that you're going to play games on the screen and the car will drive you. It's like,
no way.
Okay.
Uh-uh.
I wish my car had a few gears, you know. The Teslas are like golf carts. You put it in and drive and it goes. They're fast as can be. But, you know, mine's a little sports car, like a Lotus, and it'd be nice to go through the gears a little bit. But isn't that crazy, you know?
I would keep my eyes on the road, man. I don't know if I'm in that driver's seat, yeah. I'm looking at where we're going. I mean,
my wife's car has something called, what is that? The mode where if we're shopping, let's say we go to Macy's and we're in the mall, and the car's parked out there, a valet mode. When we come to the curb, we can push a button. The car will start and come to us. We're afraid to do it.
Wow.
We haven't tried it.
Yeah, I would. You know, the only time I would make, I would like that to happen is if every single car was like that. I think then we'd be in a better shape. That way there'd be less liability, I think.
Yeah. Well, look, I don't know about you, but I gained 5 pounds in 2020 because I didn't get to tour. Now I don't even have to walk to my car. It's like, come on.
I bought a treadmill.
There you go.
I bought a treadmill because I was out of work last year. I was I wouldn't say laid off, but my job was put on hiatus. So yeah, for the whole year, I was just like, what do I do? You know?
Yeah.
And it makes you reevaluate, because I turned 50 last year. I just turned 51. So when you're out of work, and you're going, all right, well, you know, I've got talent. I know what I'm doing, at least in the radio world. But yeah. I'm 51 years old. It's like, what if I don't get another job because I'm too old for them now? And it's like, what do I do for the rest of my life? And it's like, 2020 was a real introspective year for me. And I'm sure it was for a lot of people who maybe lost their job and didn't know if they were going to get it back, or maybe had to try a new path for themselves. You know, like, what do you do when you're...
Yeah.
You know, what can I do? I mean, I don't know. I was going to just go to, you know, Goodwill stores and find stuff and resell them online. That seems to be a big deal.
You know, it's funny, though. If you're good at what you do and you stay focused at it, it seems like you can go for things and you make them happen. Maybe it sounds naive to a lot of people, but there's something about a person that is driven to do it. How do I keep putting out albums? I have another project for next year already that I have 10 songs written for, trying to get like 15 to pick some good ones. It keeps moving forward because I can't do anything else. That's what I want to do. You can make things happen. I always say you are what you think about. If you think about it, if you want to get things at Goodwill and make it into business, you're going to do it. Because I know you're that kind of guy, you know. And that sounds to some people, Goodwill. Have you been to a Goodwill store? I go there sometimes looking for stage coats, or once in a while, they might even have an old amplifier. You never know.
You never know, man. But, you know, the thing is, and it's funny because, you know, for 20 years I've been in radio, and I moved out here to L.A. A few years ago. And when I looked for a job, I found one at one radio station, and then that led to another one, and then that led to – I was working three part-time jobs at three different radio networks. I mean, I was working full-time hours at three different part-time jobs for all of 2019. I was working my ass off.
Wow.
And two of them went away with no fault of my own. They just closed down.
Cope.
And I'm left with one. And all right, so then the pandemic hits, and now I'm like, all right, now what do I do? And then, you know, a month ago they called me up and said, hey, we need you back. And I'm thinking, they're reeling me in, you know. It's like, it's not that I can't get away from it. It's like, this is what I'm doing. This is what I do.
Yeah.
And there's a reason why I'm getting called into this. This is where I need to be. You know, this is.
And you're good at it. So you're good at it. You've left the reputation behind that people think they put you at the top of the list to think about. That's what the whole game's about.
Yeah.
You know, you need the top of the list of people's minds to make it happen.
And having the, like, you know, you said you have your toolbox about all of your experiences. You know, I have mine, and obviously not as vast, but I mean, in the world of radio, I'm behind the scenes, I'm in front of the mic, and you know, I can do a lot of things there, which makes me more valuable. So that kind of in step with you as far as making music yourself is you have so much to reach for, and there's so much need for what you have and what you know that it's going to keep you busy for a long time.
Unfortunately, I always say, I always wind up doing it because I can. I mean, I have the studio,
right.
I have the equipment, I write the songs, I'm the singer. You know, if people need something, even in my bands, I wind up doing it. Now, my keyboard player, Andrew, he's a step above me. He's like a dog and a raw piece of meat. That guy, you can't stop him. So he's taken some pressure off me because, like I said, you just can't stop him. He's already got 2022 tour planned and what we should do. I just got it this morning. Like, well, Andrew, this looks great. I hope it can happen. Let's talk to Nick, our manager, you know. But I'll tell you something. If I could find this picture, I think it's around here. We're talking about doing things at the top of your game kind of and staying at the top of the list. When I was working with Keith and Carl back in England in 1988, where is that picture? His son in high school, and he had a job washing dishes at a restaurant. And he was really not happy about it. Oh, I'm not going to find this picture. And, you know, and he's in the back seat. We're driving him. I went with Keith, and he goes, Keith said, okay, well, I'll drop you off. He goes, yeah, okay. You know, Aaron Emerson. And he's not happy. He's doing his job. And I looked around at him. I said, Aaron, whatever you do in life, do it well. And that's why I'm looking for this picture. Just when Keith died, Aaron sent me a signed picture. Ah, I don't know where it went. This says, dear Robert, whatever you do in life, do it well. Thank you for that, Aaron Emerson.
Wow.
And that meant so much to me that it stuck with him for 30 years, you know, 27 years, whatever it was. Now I'm upset because I can't find it. It sits right here by my guitar pedal against the thing, but I've had some equipment changes, so I moved it so it wouldn't get wrecked. You know how that is. I'll put it where it'll be safe. I did put where it's going to be safe. I put it on my wall.
Oh, nice.
There it is. Oh, best wishes. You know, I put the people I've worked with, Sammy Hagar, Ambrosia, Alliance, you know, look at this. This is Dwight Clark in the studio, The Catch. And I had him sign that for me. Greg Kinn, you know, there's a Sammy and John Fogerty, Neil Shawmiel, Michael Bolton. That's 1987.
Wow.
Eddie Money, just stuff, you know, and it's sort of my support mechanism, because every day I have to have ideas. Every day I have to be on 110%. I'm never hungover. I don't sleep well, but I always have enough sleep. I'm really responsible to the people come in here. And that's kind of, I think, I walk in and I'm amongst my friends, you know, and I feel, hey, And they think that too. That he's working with all those people. He's got to be good.
Right.
I could be lousy, but they're going, he's got to be good.
You're not just some guy Photoshop or photobombing, you know.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Hi, that's me again. No, I think
I need
cool.
to make up a few more. Yeah, I get in my Photoshop program. I'll make up a few more of these.
We're going back to when you were talking to Aaron Emerson.
Yeah.
You know, when you give someone advice and it resonates with them at that time, I mean, that's kind of a rare thing, isn't it? I mean, because it's like one of those, yeah, you can lead a horse to water situations, but I mean, when they're actually drinking it right away, it's like, wow, they're really taking it seriously. And that's, you know,
amazing.
Yeah, it's a life lesson. I mean, a lot of people, it takes a long time for them. Most people may not even, you know, get that lesson of waking up for themselves, you know, and because that's kind of like we're, you know, getting into, I think, now. Is I've been reading and watching a lot of documentaries on mindfulness and just the way we behave, the way we act, the way our thoughts are, what we say, and how important it is, how it affects other people. The energies and vibrations we pick up from other people. That's so important. I think that's, again, something maybe we should be taught in school or something. But, you know, I don't know if you feel more people are being open to that, or do you think there's a long way to go for people to really acknowledge. I think this is an important thing for people to acknowledge, in a sense of your place in this life, your place on this planet, and what it really means, not just to you, but to other people.
I think, unfortunately, and this is getting a little political, and I don't really like to go there, but the counterculture thing that's going on, we're tearing down statues, and, you know, Dr. Seuss have been around when you were little, when I was little, didn't hurt us, did it? We're very moral. We care about people doing well. I could go on with the list of things forever that people are trying to tear down and make go away. The name of high schools here, they wanted to change some, like Lincoln High School, because I don't know, Lincoln, I guess, didn't just free the slaves. He owned them too or something. Oh my God. You know, I mean, that's terrible, but it happened, and the kids should be shown that, hey, things change. We learn, we grow. Look where we've come from then. And Lincoln was one of the guys that helped us get here, even though he had a bad idea. You know, he was shown the wrong way at first. He overcame it. What a great lesson for kids, right? Oh my God. But no, everything's going to be erased and made a lily white. I know it's not cool to be white right now, but lily, you know, in a way, right? Wipe it clean. That is really hurting exactly what you're talking about, or what Aaron honored me with. I mean, that is one of the biggest honors of my life right there, that I said something to a crabby kid in the backseat of Keith Emerson's car, and he remembered it. And it meant something in his life, and he's given it to his sons, that message, you know? I mean, how great is that? We need more of that, and we need people to be teaching, like you said, in schools, that there is a reason that this makes a good society. Doesn't mean you have to agree with everything,
right,
but it makes society really a better place to be. And maybe, I don't know, it might even stop some of this tension that seems to be going on in the world now, that I don't understand a lot of it. I told you what side you're on is about understanding the other point of view, to have your own point of view. But I have a hard time sometimes thinking, like, tearing down statues. I mean, I understand why they're bad, but I understand that they're a teaching tool. And so I don't know why it has to get to that point. I don't know. I don't even know what I'm saying now.
I think it's, I think a lot, it's bizarre. I mean, I think we went through a pretty interesting, few years, I think, of people espousing their thoughts and, you know, feeling confident and being able to feel like they can, you know, say what they feel, even though it doesn't resonate with the majority of people. That's how they feel. And I think it's important we understand why they feel that way, you know, and I don't think it's something we should shun and neglect them. I think if there's a way we can, you know, get everybody on the same page when it comes to human, you know, empathy, that would be a...
Yeah. As, you know, as long as those people that want to be really vocal can say, well, they understand why they think that, but they're totally wrong, but I get why that person, if they could at least, that's the empathy part of it. Okay, well, I get it. Yeah, I know. you know, whatever it is. I think there needs to be understanding of the other point of view, not agreement, just right. understanding.
Yeah. But it's, I think it's got to swing, but the other side has to understand why we feel this way. And I think that's the rub, or is you're not getting that. There's like a block there of right. that they're right and we're wrong, and or you, whatever dynamic it is. But, you know, it's the direction. I mean, we only have a few minutes, and I thank you so much for hanging with me this long. I appreciate it.
I'm getting in my car room where this is my safe spot.
It's like picking a tie, man. It's like a tie rack. Exactly. It's a guitar rack. It's amazing. I would get lost and going, what am I going to play today? But I think when we, you know, society as a whole, we are moving to more of an inclusive society. I believe everyone's going to start being together and together. And I think with the verdict in the Derek Chauvin case, helps a little bit of that. And, you know, we don't need to exclude anything anymore. We're beyond that. And we're holding on to something that doesn't need to be held on to anymore, where we need to move forward. And I think moving forward, being progressive, it scares a lot of people, you know, maybe, you know, and coming around about through music again, being progressive, you know, that music itself is on the edge, you know, it pushes boundaries and, you know, and I don't know, you know, what else to say about it, but it's there's a little bit of a correlation, isn't there? Because progressive music really does push the boundaries into what's going to come up in the future, and a lot of people aren't really ready for that.
I totally agree that people are ready for it and they want it to happen. I just kind of don't agree with forgetting the past and trying to change, you know, like what kids learn in the history books and stuff. I think there's a good lesson to be learned. It just needs to be, first of all, palatable, where people want to learn it, you know, and factual, you know, it is what it is. It's not fake. You know, if it's Lincoln and he owned slaves and he freed the slaves, I use that. And I'm such a surface guy and politician in history that I could be saying it could be Bill Clinton that freed the slaves. I'm not that factual about it, because it's not that I don't care, but it's not an issue for me. I want to be a good person. I want to live my life as a good person. I want to help people. I want to do what I can. And I think that that's what people need to achieve in their life, and then their goals for their personal self. And if everybody felt that way, problem be solved, right? Just not everybody feels that way. So,
there's a, we got to start with ourselves, obviously. I think if we all start with ourselves, we all clean up our own little world, then that would spread, and everybody, then the whole world would be, you know, hopefully taken care of. I mean, it's a long call. There's a line from the show MASH that it will always, I'll always remember it. And it was Hawkeye and probably BJ, and a pilot who flew a helicopter was doing black market deals. He was getting young Korean boys to get like mines or artillery shells that he would sell on the black market. And then these kids would come into the MASH unit and they would have to help, you know, whatever. But the whole deal was that, you know, this pilot wanted to get the doctors in on their deal. And the doctor's like, screw you, and that's not going to happen. You know, get the hell out of here. And this guy's like, what are you going to try to change the world? He's like, no, just our little corner of it.
Yeah.
And that was it. That's what hit me. It was like, it's not, I'm not trying to change the world. We got to change our world, our little corner of it.
Your circle of influence, exactly.
Right. That's what needs to, and if we all had that, but I mean, we all have to be on the same page to a certain degree, don't we? I mean, we all have to agree on certain things, maybe not everything, but on the surface of, you know, every man, woman, and child should have a roof over their head, should have clothes on their body, should have food and clean water. That should be a staple of being a human being on this planet. You shouldn't have to struggle to have those necessities.
I have this band December People, and our thing is we go out for charity in November, December and play. We believe that if every little city or town, the smaller area, would take care of their own homeless and hungry, problem could be solved, because it's not that expensive and there's empty buildings in every town I've ever toured through, right? It could happen easily. It can't happen from the federal government in a big way. And obviously the state, especially in California, you're in California now. I mean, the Bay Area is the seventh largest economy in the world. I don't mean in the U.S., in the world. total economy. That means maybe more than Spain. We have a bigger economy than Spain. I don't know which of this, where we are with the seven, but, and we have so many homeless and hungry people here. It's disgusting. And because the economy is so big, the tax take from by our government in California is so big, and we can't solve that problem. If we can't do it, who can do it then? Right. We're the seventh largest economy and we're only a state.
The thing that bothers me about that is we should be fixing this, because the problem is we're stepping over people on the sidewalks instead of, and then complaining that they're there and not understanding that it's our system that made it, that put them there, because we don't care about them, you know, and it's
you know, we need to reinstate the mental institutions, unfortunately, because some of the guys and the ladies are just not going to do anything but live below a bridge. That's what they want. So something has to, they can't help themselves.
Right.
Then there's the people who lost their jobs and have families that they are smart enough to find the right place in the freeway off ramp that's warm, and they can put a box. I mean, it's disgusting that they have to do that, but they're smart and they would be able to get into housing, and they would, I mean, like the military. So these guys, for self-pride, okay, you know, we're going to help you out, but you're going to get a job. We need to clean up the city. We need to clean whatever. So your job for right now is, you know, helping the city look good and all this. And then we'll get you next step. You know, people need pride in themselves to do well, and to just give them a room, you know, and food. They feel like handouts. You need to empower them. But so there's two steps to that, and California could do it.
There are easy solutions. Just the problem getting through the red tape to get through that, and convincing people you're not going to make money on this, man. You're just going to help people.
And it's going to cost money, so someone's going to have a job from that too.
Right.
You know, it's going to. But we obviously have the money because our roads are full of potholes. I think in LA it's the same thing.
It's terrible.
Our government officials get their health care for life and their salary for all that stuff. I mean, there's ways to fix some of this, and our government officials, mayors, maybe not the mayors, but the governors, senators and stuff, they all get wealthy in the millions of dollars when they're in their office. So why do they need this everything for free afterwards too? That should go to the hungry.
It's amazing, right? It's amazing on this, how when you make it to office, obviously your care for the people goes away, I guess. And it's you're only out for yourself. I mean, it's, there's something else.
There's more to it than that, you know, just because it makes me sick to have to think that that's what it is, that they're so far above it, they can't do anything about it and help anybody. Because, I don't know, I mean, people hate Trump. And, you know, I'm not putting up Trump, but I'm putting up that nobody wanted that wall. And he still got most of it built. So, obviously, you can do things when people are against something, if you really believe in it. And our governor in California should be doing something about that homeless problem.
I like to say there's the famous line of you're only as strong as your weakest link. And when you have a part of your society sleeping on the streets, that's our weakest link as a society, to step over people and not care about people who are living in that kind of condition. So I think if we fix that, I mean, I don't think I think of it when we fix that. There's no other place than to go up. I mean, I don't know how much more rock bottom we can get, but I mean, I'm sure we can. But, you know, as far as actually helping people, getting that problem solved would help a lot more, because it'll be better for the city. I mean, I don't know. I'm a dreamer.
You notice that in the space station and the one guy left on Earth and Fawn Farewell video, that there were no homeless people. So they got to... too. So that's when it was, when the earth is abandoned, that's when it's solved.
Well, I don't think there's any homeless people in the Jetsons, are there?
Yeah, true too, yeah.
Not that I remember.
I don't think they're allowed on TV anymore because there's the short skirt or something. Anyway.
I really enjoy talking to you, man. I really appreciate you reaching out, and I love the music, love the album. Third Impression is the album. It's the last one that you're going to be putting out with Keith Emerson's sound. And influence, more or less, right?
His last song that he and I worked on together. That's the very last thing he ever did.
And looking back at your connection with him, I mean, was there anything that kind of stands out in your life? Go, wow, if I didn't do this, this wouldn't have happened.
I'll tell you a quick story. The You know the band The Tubes, White Punks on Dope, and yeah. She's a Beauty.
They're from Phoenix, yeah.
I record Roger Steen's solo album for him, and the keyboard player for December People is the Tubes keyboard player. He got really sick and almost died. He called me. He's in Santa Cruz here. He goes, man, you got to do my keyboard for the, because I started as a keyboard player, we talked about. Got to do my keyboards. We're playing in New York, Niagara Falls Friday. I said, well, Dave, it's Monday. I don't know your set. Because you got to do it. My rig's computerized. It's really complicated. You're the only guy. You run the Pro Tools, all recording. You know, I said, well, I'll call you tomorrow. You sound like you're doing better. Yeah, but they're not going to let me out. I mean, he got a piece of metal in his elbow and it went to his heart, the infections. It was pretty serious.
Jeez.
I go to see him in hospital Tuesday and he looks bad. And he says, the doctor's not letting me out for a week, man. They just stabilized me. You need to do this. I said, well, have your keyboards delivered. I'll figure it out. You know, so Tuesday afternoon, the keyboards show up. They're so complicated. I'm freaking out. I said, Dave, I can't do this. The keyboards are, you know, you have to do it. Okay. So I try to change them around and get them. I try to learn the songs at the same time. I rehearsed myself on Wednesday night, Roger Steen calls the guitar player. I didn't know at that point, says, well, I guess I better come by tomorrow and rehearse with you. And I said, Roger, I'm hanging by a thread here. I'm learning this stuff. You just have to trust me. I will have the parts. He goes, you know, you need to sing the high harmonies too. I'll have that. But if you come in and rehearse with me and start telling me differently, it's going to go out of my brain. I'm locking it in. He goes, well, I have more say-so. I'm the musical director for the band. I said, Roger, I played with Keith Emerson. Hardest thing I've ever done in my life. And I had a hit record. He said, all right, well, we'll see you in Niagara Falls. I mean, that's what Keith Emerson did for my musical life. Besides being a friend and a guy that I love dearly, who could have done that for me as a musician, that I could say, I'm not going to rehearse, I'll see you there. A famous band, right?
Right, right.
They didn't talk to me in the plane flight. Went to San Francisco, we were on the plane together. They went, got on stage, sound check. They were not happy. Second song, both Fee, the singer, and Roger turned around and went. And that, all because of Keith Emerson, I think. That's the way I feel about it.
Right, right. So,
you know, yeah, it's affected my life in a much bigger way than that, but that's the cherry on top right there.
Well, that's great. That's a cool story, man. I appreciate it. That's thank you for sharing all this.
Greg Ken and I have a song called Saucers on Broadway about his seeing a flying saucer when he's young.
Yeah, I interviewed him.
Actually, Southway is where it was, but Broadway makes a better hook to the song. So he'll be talking to you soon.
I hope so. I chatted with him a few years ago, and he told us that story when he was on the roof of his house, and
yep,
and it came right to his face.
It's a song now.
And now it's a song. That's great. Yeah. I can't wait for that.
They're also releasing government records, in June maybe, about this? So we're going to get some more information.
Right. Yeah, yeah. They've been leaking that up slowly but surely, but maybe it's just to appease us and to shut people down. You know, so, all right, here's this. Be quiet. Get out of here. You know? But
there's space aliens coming to get you. You got a lot more to worry about.
Not soon enough. Not soon enough.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's got to be some wisdom out there somewhere in the solar system, right?
Well, hopefully it'll leak to us. You know, they say aliens do contact us in a way that they throw down into the ether and then we pick it up and we can do whatever we want with it. That's why you can have the same idea as someone else, but yet they make it happen. Someone else doesn't, but it's the same thought that's going out there. They put it out there. We're the ones that need to act on it. So, and a lot of people, when you're drowned out in news and bills and family and you're not paying attention, you're not going to pick up these signals.
Yeah.
And that's where it needs to start. People need to be tuning in a little bit more.
That's a good way to end this too, because that's been a lot of our conversation, you know, and it's important. I'm looking forward to talking to you again next year when I have this new thing going. And if Greg and I get this Saucers on Broadway song out, you'll be talking to him sooner than later too. But I figure that's a good thing to put out when more information gets leaked.
Yeah.
You know?
No doubt. That sounds like a pretty cool thing. I can't wait to hear that. I've been jamming out to the new album and it sounds really good, man. I really dig it.
I appreciate it. You know, it's the last one in the series. There's three of them now and I wasn't going to do it. I didn't want to do a follow-up to the last album, but they told me that the last album did so well at the record company. And they have all the bands from the 80s, like Journey and Whitesnake. They have Yes and Boston. They have everybody said, we can't tell you what they sold, but you did really well. You need to do a follow-up. And I just felt that without Keith around, you know, I only had the one song. I told him, I only have one song. Well, let's hear it. You know, I'll tell you what, I'll write seven more songs that I think Keith would have liked to have worked on. If I can do that, then we'll talk about the Emerson Berry song that I have that wasn't used on the last album. And it just so happened that the songs, I mean, it wasn't like easy. It didn't happen in one day. It took a whole year, but they kind of flew out of me in a way that was natural. And I hadn't thought about this in the last album, but I mean, I was half the writer and the singer of Three in 1988 when we first started. And Keith Emerson was half the writer and the sound of it. And I had 10 years of classical piano lessons, so I can play. So I kind of had a lot of the pieces to finish up those other songs without him. And then, of course, go in and to the 9-minute piece, Never. I don't know if you got that far in the album, but it's 9 minutes, you know.
Yeah, you got two niners on there.
Yeah.
Now you open up with one. But with Never, you know, that's the song that was you didn't get on the Rules Have Changed. So yeah. When you were writing the other songs, I mean, did you want to keep in theme with that, or is it kind of like carte blanche to just be creative and open as much as you wanted?
You know, it's interesting. I really struggled with doing this album. I didn't think I should do it because the Rules Have Changed, the previous one, for the people listening to you that don't know about that one. It did so well, and it really honored Keith, and he was involved in all of it until he died. And I felt funny about it. But when I finally saw that the songs are coming together and it was worthy of the Three sound and everything, I thought, you know, I can only do half this album with that style that is partly my style, you know, with Keith. The next half of the album needs to lead toward what I might do next. Because just to manufacture the Three sound for the next album, like the fourth album, it doesn't make any sense. You know, it needs to spring off the Keith and mine working together. So the first song on the album you mentioned, Top of the World, is fairly long. It starts with a minute of acoustic guitar, kind of Celtic dual guitar. And that was a choice, actually, because everybody that listens to my music with Three is expecting a lot of keyboards. And I thought, you know, I want to put that first. People are going to go, wait a minute, this is all guitar. Where are the keyboards? I'm expecting Emerson keyboards. I'm going to either chase away the people that won't stay with it and say, well, this crap, you know, and they won't get to Fond Farewell and Never and all the things that have the big keyboard sound, or it will take them on a journey that will be partly leading them to what I'll do next year, let's say. Fortunately for me, the reviews of this album are even better than the last album, and people are liking that little piece of it because I think it sort of weaves the web as you listen to the whole album. Every song's kind of different, but people say they fit together. So I have no idea if I accomplished that or not. I think I did, but until you hear it and you hear there's a jazz piece with Emotional Trigger and there's, you know, a couple of really long pieces, then there's What Side You're On, super short, you know, you never know.
No, I was digging it. I for Top of the World, it was, you know, it came at you kind of chill, and then all of a sudden, you know, you're on this ride where, you know, it hits you from the left, and comes back and hits you from the right. Then, you know, you're on a downhill, you know, screaming roller coaster for a second, and then it kind of chills back again. It's quite the ride, you know. And I think, you know, with prog rock, in a sense, you kind of get that kind of leeway, don't you? That's kind of expected.
Yeah, but the trick is to make it flow and make the changes happen where they feel, you know, I've heard a lot of progressive rock stuff where people just glue the parts together. The keyboard player has an idea, the guitar player has an idea. They glue it together and it switches gears like you're in a race going through the stick shift of a car, you know. And for me, there's no beauty in that. There's no magic to it. And that's the hard part. Now, I try to do that. I try to make those segues and stuff, which is what Keith was famous for in our music too. He did those musical bits that tied everything together. But I don't know until someone says, no, it took me on the ride and I followed it, you know, yeah. Or no, it jarred me. One guy said the keyboard solo in the middle of Fond Farewell was stuck out. It's too edgy. Oh, okay. So he didn't think I accomplished it there. But basically, people are thinking it holds together, which is, I couldn't ask for more.
That's what I was, like I said, I listened to the whole album and just listening from front to back and thinking, going like, I mean, there's a nice flow to it, man. I mean, you know, you got your ups, you got your downs, and it's, you know, you can chill and also kind of bounce your head to it pretty well. And it's got a nice flow to it. I really enjoyed it. The first Top of the World really kind of stuck in my head. You know, I'm a big fan of long songs. And I really am, and that's one of my favorite things about music. And I always wanted to ask someone who makes long songs, are you set out to start off with a long song? Are you like, I need to make a 9 or 10 minute song? Or is it kind of like you start off with a song and you keep adding and adding, and before you know it, you're up to 9 or 10 minutes long?
You know, it happens both ways. But on this album, like Top of the World, I have a motto for myself. It's easier to fix an idea than to get one. So I put it down. If it sucks, I go, you know, there's possibilities. I'm going to come back to that tomorrow or next month or something. And I weave it. Top of the World, I set out to start with acoustic guitar. Keith liked Celtic music. I produced a band called Tempest, which is Celtic music. I love it. I wanted to have a little of that flavor. My theory was to pull the switch. Then people go, whoa, wait a minute. What's this? So, and that would make them listen, I'm hoping. But as far as the song developing, for me, it needed the parts that happen. I like a good solo section. I mean, this album is more heavy on guitar, obviously. And I worked hard to up my guitar skills a little bit. And I like the really heavy rhythm of things. And that song runs the gamut between a lot of parts. I didn't even know, honestly. I'm doing it all, mixing it and everything, and until I had to figure out the vinyl, which is being pressed right now, I didn't realize didn't think it was that long. I mean, you know, it doesn't matter on a CD or online, you just do it, right? And I thought, well, I know Never's 9 minutes because it wouldn't fit on the last album, but I didn't realize Top of the World was that long. I feel kind of stupid not knowing that, but it just didn't matter because it was a piece of music the way I thought it should be.
I dug the beginning part, like you mentioned, the Celtic music and the kind of the little sound there, and I liked it, man. It really grabbed my attention, and it grabbed me in, and it pulled me in. So I really enjoyed it. I question about lining up your album song by song. You know, back in the day, that was such an important thing to do. You got to start with? What are you going to end with? Nowadays, I mean, it's kind of really arbitrary in a sense, where unless you're building an actual concept album, is there a reason for the specific order you have, or is it just kind of like these are the songs, and did you have a planning out as far as lining them up?
Good question, because as you're talking, my brain's going back 10, 15 years, going two fast songs and a slow, two fast, whatever, you know, right? Whatever it used to be, or four fast songs and a slow one in the middle, or, you know, or do we end with the slow one, let it go out like Pink Floyd, you know?
Right.
And on this one, it was funny because I took the two big chances. I knew Never was going to be last. That's the anchor. On the 1988 album, Desde La Vida was the big song. It was 8 minutes, maybe. I don't remember exactly. Maybe it was 13. I don't know. It was a long, long tune. And it's sort of the favorite of the progressive rock people of the Three and the ELP fans and stuff. They like Desi La Vida. So that anchors the start of it. Never is going to be the very last song. And of course it fades out into the reverb and stuff, into the abyss. This is the last album. There is no more. I want it to go away. It never happened again, even though that's not what the song is about. Mm-hmm. But I decided to take two chances at the beginning to have that heavy guitar thing that doesn't get the big keyboards to the middle. And then the second song is the shortest song on the album. And it hits super hard. I just thought, you know what? I'm going to go for the gusto of what this album is, from all the way to the left, all the way to the right, kind of span what it spans. And then let it unfold after that with the different feels and things. So I didn't use the typical theory. And not one person has mentioned what side you're on, in which I find interesting. And it could be because they think it's about
oh, you have to be a conservative, or you have to be a liberal, right? It's not what it's about. What it's about is, if you and I disagree on something, I have a right to my opinion if I can at least understand why you think what you think, right? If I say, oh, you know, you can only see one eye back there in your background, east side. I mean, shouldn't you be seeing two? You go, oh, no, here's why you do the one eye. It's the three of them, and there's an eye. I could go, oh, okay. Yeah, but I don't like that, but I understand why you'd have the one eye on each side. That's what the song's about. You know, I need to understand your point of view before I can really stand up tall with my point of view. If we disagree, and if we don't, that's even better.
Right.
That's what the song's about. But I think people might hear it as a divisive kind of song. You know, hey, you better figure out what side of the line you're on because there's a fight coming. It's nothing to do with that. It's actually about getting along.
We're talking with Robert Barry here. Third Impression is the new album. 3.2 is the name it's under. That's your that'd be kind of like the band, right, in a sense, but you're the band.
3.2 is my touring band, too. We went out in 2019, 27 cities and 32 days, and my voice held up, so I was happy about that. And it's a fantastic band. We did my 30-year history of progressive rock, and that starts with Steve Howe in GTR, a couple songs. Three goes to a band called Ambrosia, which started as a progressive band, then became Blue Eyed Soul later, you know, with Life Beyond L.A. My album Pilgrimage to a Point, which has songs that I wrote for Keith and even Greg Lake and stuff that were never used, and all the way up to the 3.2 album. So it was really demanding, and especially the keyboard player that I found, he said yes right away, and I said, maybe you ought to listen to some of the songs first, because we're going to be doing something I did for a Magna Carta record label. They did an ELP tribute album where I did it. And I did some songs with Jordan Rudess, Simon Phillips, and Mark Wood on violin. And if you know who Jordan Rudess is, he's an incredible keyboard player. I don't know anybody else that can play his stuff. And Andrew Collier, my keyboard player for the band, had to learn that, along with all the Emerson stuff and all the things that I do. Now, the excitement got me. He goes, maybe I should have listened first, but I would have said yes anyway.
So when you're building a band, I mean, you play all the instruments too. So how do you decide what you're going to be playing and everyone else is going to be playing?
I started as a keyboard player in my band Hush. That was my first professional band here. I had a record contract and things. I was sort of keyboard and guitar. Then I just don't like being behind the keyboards. You know, I was stuck. I became the lead singer in my band, and I just wanted to be out front. And I found that playing bass for me was more like a Sting kind of guy, you know? I could sing and I could play, and I was very independent with both things. Plus, it drives the band a little bit. I didn't want to play drums in the band, but I still wanted to drive it, you know, push it a little bit, pull it back a little bit. And the bass being so big and deep, and you get a big enough amplifier, you know, you tear down the whole place with the bass. I chose bass as it is the most comfortable place on stage for me.
I want to thank Robert Barry for joining us and for sharing his stories. Always interesting to hear from an accomplished musician. All those background things we don't know about, you know, it's kind of spices it up a little bit. And I want to thank you guys for tuning in, for taking the time to listen to the show. I do appreciate that. It means a lot. And until the next time we do meet again, you can always check out archived shows on themothershipradioshow.com, on Spotify. I think it's on Apple and iTunes, and just Google the Mothership Radio Show. I'm pretty sure mine will be the first one to pop up. There are other motherships out there because, you know, it can't be just one. I understand that, but I think the Mothership Radio Show itself is unique on its own. But I might be a little biased when I say that. So until next time, until we meet again, stay strange and unusual, my friends. Sorry, had a rhyme.
Thank you, and keep watching the skies.